Okay, we are on page 144. By the way, I finished all of my citations from this book, and I put them in the additional materials section of this study. So you can go to that section and download the 350 or so citations that I have. It's a Word file, so if you remember to do that, then you know you'll see what I'm going to talk about as we go along. Okay, so let's go to 144. It's actually 144, 145. There's a lot of really interesting stuff here. And it starts with the last sentence at the bottom of 144 where he says, creation involves concealment. The word olam, universe, is semantically linked to the word ne'alam, hidden. So it's interesting, and I have a little marginal note that says, in Greek, the same thing is happening because in Greek, the word aletheia, which means truth, is really it's the negative not and the idea of hidden. So what it's saying is that truth in Greek was revelation, was the revealing of something. And we have the same thing going on here, right? So it's really interesting that both of these ancient cultures viewed truth, viewed the idea of what's actually happening in the universe as something that was hidden and needed to be revealed. And then he says on 145, the last sentence or so in the first paragraph, God, as we encounter him in the Torah, is like a parent who knows he must hold back, let go, refrain from intervening if his children are to become responsible and mature. Right? So the purpose, according to Sachs, the purpose of this hiddenness is no different than a parent who wants a child to grow up and doesn't do everything for him so that he will discover for himself what the parent already knows to be the truth. And then the middle paragraph, the one that has all the italics in it on 145, the biblical answer. Oh, he said, let's talk about the connection here. He says, but there's a limit. To efface himself entirely would be the equivalent of abandoning the world, etc. He says that God may or may not do. How then does God leave a trace of his presence on earth? The biblical answer, this is the important paragraph. The biblical answer is not philosophical. A philosophical answer, and I'm thinking here of the mainstream of Western philosophy, beginning with Plato and Descartes, would be one that applies universally. Right? That is, at all times, in all places. Okay, so let's stop right there for a second. So, understand what he just said. What he said is that the Western civilization's view of the purpose of philosophy is to create timeless truths. That is, true statements that apply in every place and at every time. Right? That comes from Plato right through Descartes, all of that history of 2,500 years of Western philosophy. And what he's saying is the biblical position is not that. It isn't Western. Okay? He says, but there's no answer that applies at all times in, according to the Bible, right? But there's no answer that applies at all times and places. That is why philosophy cannot and never will understand the apparent contradiction between divine creation and human free will, or between divine presence and the empirical world in which we reflect, choose, and act. In other words, what he's saying is the biblical idea is about immanence, not transcendence. So it's interesting that the Western view pretty much rests on a transcendent view of God, which means that I would look for propositions that are always true, that so that whenever I read a biblical text in light of Western philosophy, I'm thinking, oh, how does that apply everywhere and at all times, right? I mean, we get confused about this. A lot of Western theology is built on this idea that what the Bible gives you is timeless truths. Right? What Sachs is saying is that's not the case. The biblical text is basically a narrative that applies to a certain people at a certain time. It doesn't mean that it has universal applicability no matter where you are and at what time you are. So he says, next sentence, Jewish thought is counter-philosophical. It insists that truths are embedded precisely in particular times and places. It doesn't mean that you have nothing but, situational ethics. It doesn't mean that you have only conventionalism. It means that whatever the truth is, it's buried in the narrative of the text. So let's think about something like the Ten Commandments or the Beatitudes, both of them, right? The Ten Commandments and the Beatitudes are both contextual and located within a temporal environment, right? So if I want to understand what's happening in the Ten Commandments and I want to see how that applies to me, I have to first understand what it meant to the people who heard it in the context in which they lived, right? Then I can extract from that perhaps principles that will have application where I am. I'm getting this poor network connection. Can you still hear me? No.
Yes, I can hear you.
I don't know what to do about this. Are we connected, Dennis?
We're not. Yes,
yes? You can hear me?
We can hear you.
Dennis, no, you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you.
No. Okay. Okay, so how is it now? Is it good now?
Still clear.
Can you hear what I'm saying? Yes?
Yeah. Still clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Skip, you've been clear all along.
5 on 5.
Okay. All right, so what I'm saying is, what Sachs is pointing out is that the biblical approach is to discover, to find this hidden truth, this stuff that has to be revealed within the context of real people in real time, right? So now, many folks treat the Beatitudes as though they're timeless truths applicable to everybody wherever they are, right? And so they don't bother to look at the Hebraic context of the Beatitudes, thinking that what Jesus is providing are statements that will be the same no matter where you are, right? And of course, what we know from our long studies in exegetical systems is that that's not true, that whatever is happening in the biblical text has to be understood within the context of the people who heard it. And then from there, we work out the application. So now he says at the bottom of this page, The holy is where, this is the last couple lines. The holy is where God is experienced as absolute presence, not accidentally, but essentially. This can only take place through the total renunciation of human will and initiative, right? So look what he's saying. If, as long as there's human initiative and human desire within the encounter, you can't experience the true holiness of God, because that has to all be put aside before you can come into the divine presence. So what we are discovering, of course, is Leviticus is going to give us instructions about how to do that. Okay, so let me see. Who has a hand up? Somebody.
That's me, Skip. I'm Pam.
Okay. Yeah, Pam, go ahead and add whatever you wish.
I haven't read this part yet, but this is exactly the conversation we had yesterday during our Torah portions, is because everybody is perplexed about, why do we not have the power of God with us? Why can we not experience the things that the early church experienced, and so on and so forth? And this was exactly the conclusion that we came to. It's really interesting. And I truly believe that. But our whole discussion yesterday had very little to do with the text and a whole lot to do with what's wrong with us. And we came to the conclusion that we don't understand holiness. We don't, as Americans, we have the hardest time laying down our own self-will. And in particular, what we discussed for hours was the fact that it's not, that we can't just approach the text like, mark off A, B, C, D, now everything should work.
Yeah,
Yeah, it was
really
powerful.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and we came to the conclusion that we have to be not just walking in his ways, but listening to his voice as well. And that was,
yes.
This text is just blowing me away right now.
Yeah, and I think on top of that, we have to realize that the hiddenness of God, the fact that he's not obvious to everyone, is intentional. Because what Sachs is saying is, you can read through the biblical text and see what happened to the people who experienced God, but that doesn't mean that it automatically is going to be something that you experience. This essential hiddenness means that, as the prophets say, you have to pry this out, right? Remember what he says? When you diligently search, when you look with all your heart, then maybe you find it. So there's that sense of passionate desire to understand before you can really grasp what God is trying to do in this invisible handiwork that we're so often complaining that we just don't have enough insight into. Okay,
well,
so let's continue on 146. Oh, go ahead.
And that it doesn't happen for us all the time. That there's no need for miracles every second. We're supposed to be responsible for stewarding this world.
Yes.
God helps us when we need help and cry out for it. But other than that, we really are responsible. And we had a marvelous discussion yesterday over just this exact thing. It's so cool.
Okay. And I think the other point that I would want to make is that a lot of times we feel as though I just don't know what God wants me to do. You know, it's not clear to me, right? And then we lapse either into depression that we don't know what God wants, or discouragement that there's something wrong with us because we don't understand. And both of those are wrong, because what Sachs is saying is this is an intentional process. And I'm glad he uses the example of the parent and the child. A child doesn't often understand all the things that a parent is trying to do. The parent might see why he's doing what he's doing, but the child doesn't see it. Only in retrospect, perhaps years later, does the child understand, oh, that's why my parents did that, right? And that's kind of where we are with God. He's not going to reveal himself all the time. And in fact, in the biblical narrative, especially in the Genesis account, it's very rare. I mean, Abraham goes for decades without any interaction with God, right? And I think we have unfortunately succumbed to the Western idea that we should be able to apprise the truth whenever we think logically, and it should be instantly available to us. And so we have this notion that somehow we're not equipped. We're either not equipped, or God is just so obtuse that we just don't understand what he wants, instead of thinking, well, you know, I'm on the path and I'll just keep going until he shows up sometime, if he shows up. Okay, let's go to 146, because he's still talking about this. He says, we err to if we think that God is capricious, jealous, angry, a myth spread by early Christianity in an attempt to define itself as a religion of love, superseding the cruel, harsh, retributive God of the Old Testament. When the Torah itself uses such language, it speaks in the language of humanity. That is to say, in terms that people will understand. Okay, so now, you have to be really careful here. Because of humanity is almost, it pushes us almost to treating the statements about God as though they're anthropomorphic. That is, that they don't really talk about what God actually is like, but they're only accommodations to human thought. So I want to I underline this, because I want to make sure that Sachs is not going to push us to the point where he says, like some Christian theologians, oh, those statements of God about, like, God changing his mind aren't real, because the true transcendental God would never do that. They're only accommodations to human thought. And I don't believe that that's the case, because I believe that the narrative that we have in the text is about the real God, the God that's revealed to us. He says at the bottom of the next paragraph, if civilization is to be guided by love, justice, and respect for the integrity of creation, then there must be moments in which we leave the I behind and encounter the fullness of being in all its glory. Okay? And that's true, but there must be moments. It's not a continuous revelation of the glory of God. You know, it isn't like you can show up every week at the synagogue or a church and discover that, you know, God is always revealed and present. I mean, this is a, according to Sachs, I think, and in most experiences that I've had, a long and struggling process. And I see that in the biblical text when you read about the characters in the Bible. I mean, even Yeshua, who has probably the best relationship with the Father that you could imagine, still struggles. So it's not as though we're going to eliminate that vocabulary. I can't tell if anybody can hear me or not. Okay.
You're bouncing in.
You were bouncing around, yeah. And we didn't really get your last sentence or thought.
Okay, so I don't know what to do about this connection today. It's really, really bad, and I thought it was going to be okay, but I can't connect on the land because I'm still not in the U.S. and I'm not in Europe anymore. Okay, my point at the end was that we want to make sure that we don't assume that because God doesn't show up every day for us, that there's something wrong with us, or that God just, you know, has decided not to reveal himself. Because it seems to me that the biblical characters, from Abraham right on through, only experience God intermittently. And even Yeshua experiences, who has this closest connection with God, still experiences struggle in that relationship. So, you know, maybe that's intentional, because when Yaakov is renamed Israel, you remember what the definition is, that you've struggled with God and man and persevered. And maybe that's really where we are. Okay, are we good? We can go to 151.
Yes.
Okay, so it's the 1-2-3rd paragraph on 1. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I have raised hands. I see that two people have raised their hands, but that's Pam and Adi. So, Adi, why don't you start us with whatever comment you want to make? Oh, Esther's raised her hand now, too. Okay, go ahead, Adi. Do you hear me? No. Okay, how about Pam? Did you want to say something?
I can hear you.
I did. I wanted to say that you mentioned Yeshua struggling. He struggled to the very end. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Yes.
Yes. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, although I don't think that that verse is a verse of struggle. I think that verse is a reference to the psalm of vindication, but certainly in the garden we see that. Okay, Esther, you have something you want to say, Esther?
Yes, I felt such a painful jab in my heart reading this idea that Christianity attempted to define itself as a religion of love, and it really made me think of the importance of fighting and working hard for a personal relationship with God, because I find this, that just like in a marriage, there's always such a high chance of misunderstanding unless you can rely on a long experience, right, with a spouse. I mean, if I did not know that my husband is loyal and loving and, you know, I could interpret lots of things as being cruel, you know, because as a human, I would be totally prone to misunderstanding. Yeah. But because I have a history with my husband and I know that he loves me and I know that he's faithful and, you know, has proven himself over the length of our relationship, then I can be certain of our relationship even when things are unclear. And I feel that maybe Christianity ran away with interpretation without relying on experience, on the experience with the God of love.
Well, I think that's a good point, because remember that ultimately Christianity is based on Western philosophy. And Western philosophy, as Sachs has pointed out just in this discussion, is it pursues timeless truths. Well, timeless truths don't require experience. They only require logic, right? I mean, nobody's going to argue that I need an experience of 7 plus 7 equals 14 for it to be true. It's always true. It's the mathematical certainty that underlies the Western idea of truth. So what that means is I don't have to look at the narrative. I just extract those timeless principles as though they, as though I don't need the context in which they came out of, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that Christianity can discount all of Jewish history as not relevant to its theology, because what it's saying is the theology is based on the timeless truths that God revealed in Jesus, and man, I'm getting dropped all the time. So I suppose that you couldn't hear what I said on that last, right? Are we still getting dropped all the time?
We could not hear the last part of your statement. You are correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So what I said is that I'm just getting, it's constant network problems. So what I said was that because Western philosophy is based in mathematical truth, which does not require experience, it only requires logic, mathematical logic. Therefore, Western philosophy and consequently Christian theology can discount the history of the Jews as irrelevant to the timeless propositions about God, right? So Christianity can say God is love and completely dismiss all of the evidence that we have in the Tanakh that shows us that there's more emotions than just love involved here, right? It can dismiss that because those are simply situational and contextual, where Christianity is looking for the ultimate and absolute truth in each one of its propositions, right? So that leads to a theology of transcendence, a theology where God is completely removed from my environment. Hold on just a second. I need to. Okay, so that means that the theology of Christianity pushes me to final answers so that I have the truth. And of course, all that does is make me feel as though I'm not the one who truly understands what's going on, because after all, I still have confusion and doubt and concern and struggle and all this kind of stuff that I read in the biblical text, but that's not part of the pursuit of Christian theology. Okay? So did we catch all that, or are we still getting disconnected?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right. So let's go to 151 and that the third paragraph on 151. He says, talking about the priest and the prophet. The twin perspectives of the priest and the prophet correspond to the twin perspectives on creation represented respectively by Genesis 1:1-2:3, spoken in the priestly voice with an emphasis on order, structure, divisions, and boundaries, and Genesis 2:4-3:24, spoken in the prophetic voice with an emphasis on nuances and dynamics of interpersonal relationships. Okay. That, I think, is really helpful because there's a lot of discussion about how in the world can the first chapter of Genesis be so different than the second and third chapters of Genesis. And what he's saying is that's because we have two different perspectives happening in Genesis. We need both of them. We need the priestly voice, which is about order and control. So we have the second verse, which says that the world was the tohu vavohu, it was filled with chaos and void, and the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the face of the deep, and he brought order to everything. And then it lists all the order. And all of the creation narrative, day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, are ordering days. Okay? And then we have the second story, which begins in chapter 2, verse 4, and it looks like a rehash of the first story, but with, you know, more detail. But then what Sachs is pointing out is, no, it's not a rehash. It's a different perspective. Now it's the interpersonal relationship perspective. The first perspective is sovereign creation. The second perspective is interpersonal relation. And now you see how those two fit together. And they're not in competition with each other, nor are they two separate temporal events. They're just the same actions from two different perspectives, one from the priest and one from the prophet. I think that was very helpful to understand the Genesis account. And then he says on 152, the second paragraph, if the prayers were instituted by the patriarchs, then their origin is prophetic. If they were established to replace the sacrifices, then their province is priestly. Priests were forbidden to act spontaneously, but prophets did so as a matter of course. Someone who saw prayer as priestly would, like Rabban Gamliel, emphasize the importance of the precise text. One who saw it as prophetic would, like Rabbi Eliezer, have understood by the Talmud Yerushalayim, value spontaneity and each day try to say something new. Okay, so this is really cool because what it says is these two perspectives, priestly and prophet, also influence our liturgy. So, if you went to Oxford like me, you end up in the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church has a common book of prayer, and it's no different than the Siddur, right? Which means that there are prayers that are written down. They're not flexible. You repeat them exactly as they're written. And in fact, in the Siddur, you repeat them with the same genuflection and all the other kind of things that go along with it, right? So there's all kinds of instructions in there about written prayer. And if you grew up in the West like me, you think, oh my gosh, this is so ritualistic. It's so confining. How come I don't have the ability to just speak my mind or my heart to God, right? And of course, what you realize now is that from the priestly perspective, it's all about order. You know, it takes three steps back, bow in a certain way, say these words. So that's really important because it establishes the order, the structure. But the prophetic voice is the one that cries out to God in spontaneously, and it's also a part of the structure, right? So that means that you would expect to find both of these in the biblical text, and you do find both of them in the biblical text, but you often find only one or the other in a worship community. So the Protestant church tends to be push only toward the prophetic, and everybody thinks that they should just pray according to their heart, right? It doesn't have a prayer liturgy, whereas the Catholic Church has a prayer liturgy, but removed from the people usually. So you have all these kinds of different perspectives going on. And what Sachs is saying is, don't you see that the Bible has both of these and you need both of them in order to really approach God? You have to have Genesis 1 structure and you have to have Genesis 2 relationship. Okay. And the last sentence in that little section, he says, without structure, Judaism would have no continuity, but without spontaneity, it would have no fresh life. And so now it seems to me that's a nice little way for us to judge how we're doing. Do we have structure and do we have spontaneity? We need both. Okay? All right, let's go forward. Page 155. I have only one comment on 155. It's at the bottom of the last full paragraph. He's talking about Moses said to Aaron, he says, nevertheless, Aaron remained silent. When all the explanations and consolations have been given, grief remains unassuaged. We would not be human were it otherwise. That surely is the message of the book of Job. Job's comforters were pious in their intentions, but God preferred Job's grief to their vindication of tragedy. I think that, you know, we did a lot of study in Job. I wrote a lot of stuff about Job over the last year, and I think that Sack's insight here is really helpful because we want Job, we want the story of Job to come up with a happy ending. We want resolution to all of those issues that come up in Job. But what he's saying, what Sacks is saying is that Job is really, the power of Job is that it reflects the true human condition. And the true human condition is that grief is often unresolved. That grief is often, it often doesn't have a way to find comfort. And of course, at the end of Job, when we're expecting God to come in and vindicate Job, we get God's sovereign approach to Job, which says, where were you when all this stuff was happening? And who are you to even ask these questions? And we feel as though that's an affront. But the fact of the matter is what Sacks is saying is, if we didn't have these kinds of feelings that Job tries to express, if we didn't have this grief and this sorrow, then we wouldn't be human. Because that the message is not that we want to find comfort, but that there's a real need to be able to experience that in front of God and not be rejected simply because we're grieving or because we've discovered sorrow or remorse or something like that. And so I really found that that was a very helpful comment about the book of Job. Okay. If anybody has comments, that's fine. Otherwise, we go to 158. There's a lot of stuff on 158 we want to talk about. Okay?
I just want to
page
say,
150.
Go ahead. What he says about grief is so true, but and also, like, you think anything that happens to us, we think we're going to go through a process and find a solution at the end, and either we don't find it, or it's not at all what we thought it was going to be, but we discover God in the midst of it. So.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the whole point of Job, you know, I've often raised questions at the end of Job where it says, and, you know, he had more children and he was given more wealth than he ever had before. And I always raise the question, yeah, but he still has to go to the graveyard and visit those siblings that were taken away. And that unresolved piece, I think, is the piece that we really need to concentrate on, because what Job has to find is comfort in God in spite of what life presents continuously every time he goes to the graveyard, right? Every time he visits there. So the grief doesn't go away. It is a part of the human condition, but Job has to find some kind of resolution, I suppose. I mean, I don't think it's resolution. I think he has to find some kind of purpose that's greater than that experience. And I think that's essentially what happens at the end of the book. Okay. Let's go to 158. The first couple three paragraphs are really interesting. And he starts off with Rabbi Monk reminds us that the first commandment God gave the first human being was a dietary law, et cetera. You can eat from any tree in the garden, et cetera, et cetera. The dietary laws in Parashat Shemini parallel the prohibition given to Adam. As then, so now, a new era in the spiritual history of humankind, preceded by an act of creation, is marked by laws about what one may or may not eat. Why? As with sex, so with eating. These are the most primal activities shared with most other forms of life. And I think that helps us recognize what's really happening in the Levitical laws concerning kosher, right? That it's the most fundamental thing. So the two most fundamental things, sustenance and reproduction, are the ones that get the most attention because it's a constant reminder of our relationship with God. Now he says on the other, and then he continues with the next paragraph. On the other hand, there are hedonistic cultures in which food and sex are seen as pleasures and pursued as such. On the other are ascetic cultures marked by monastic seclusion in which sex is avoided and kept, and eating kept to a minimum. The former emphasize the body, the latter the soul. Judaism, by contrast, sees the human situation in terms of integration and balance. We are body and soul. Hence, the Judaic imperative, neither hedonistic nor ascetic, but transformative. We are commanded to sanctify the activities of eating and sex. From this flow the dietary laws and the laws of family purity, two key elements of Kedusha, the life of holiness. Okay? So, interesting that Sachs is pointing out that the most fundamental parts of human life are transformed into self-control and sanctity. And in doing that, Judaism recognizes the integration of body and soul. I would say that that's obvious from the very beginning because the vocabulary, nefesh or neshama, is not capable of being separated into a bodily component and a soul spiritual component. It's a homogenized view of man. So if you have a homogenized view of man, then these activities need to be sanctified in order to say that the very fundamental things about human existence are really not accommodations to, but they're displays of God's sovereignty over those fundamental things. And now he continues this idea on 160 and 161. And he says, two paragraphs. We now understand what's at stake in the prohibition of eating certain species of animals, birds, fish, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the statement after Job 38:41. They exist for their own sake, not for the sake of humankind. The vast universe, the earth itself, with its myriad of species it contains, has an integrity of its own. Yes, after the flood, God gave humans permission to eat meat, but this was a concession. As if to say, kill if you must, but let it be animals, not other humans that you kill. Okay? So the interesting thing here is that he's saying, because we would say, okay, wait a minute, why are there prohibitions over these certain kinds of things that are digestible? And he's saying, it's because the borders that are established in creation specify some things that belong to themselves and don't cross over those lines. And he says at the top of 161, right? Some species must be protected, given their freedom, granted their integrity, left unsubjected to human devices and desires. The new creation, the sanctuary, marks a dignity for the old creation, especially its wild, untamed creatures. Not everything in the universe was made for human consumption. That's the key. Not everything in the universe was made for human consumption. In the face of nature, there must be reverence and restraint. Okay? So I think that's really important because it tells us how different the Western view of the Genesis prime directive is. So the prime directive in Genesis is the statement, be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth and take control over such and such. And the Western view of that is that everything in the universe is designed for human beings to either use or take control of or manage. Okay? And what Sachs is pointing out is that that's not true. that not everything in the universe was designed for human beings. Some of it was designed to function without human interference. And when humans interfere, it creates disorder in the universe, right? So that's really interesting, because now that means that for us to understand our place in the universe is to first understand those things that we shouldn't mess with, right? Okay. Do we have comments on that before we go? No? Okay, so we'll continue.
Hey, Skip.
Yes.
So you're talking like the fish that are down in the deep that we can't get to that live perfectly fine without us.
Yes. And there's a whole bunch of other things that would live perfectly fine without us that we can get to, and that whenever we interfere with those things, it creates disaster in nature, right? I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples. When we interfere with the balance in the Everglades, we introduce a predator that never was there in the first place, the python, and it's wreaking havoc across the Everglades because it wasn't designed to be there, right? It goes down to an insect that we introduce. That whenever human beings start trying to manage the natural world, they inevitably mess it up, right? Because it was designed in a certain kind of way to be perfectly functional without human interference. I mean, that comes down to, things like fires in California. We haven't learned to leave nature alone. What we've assumed from our our mistranslation of the text is that Western religion believes that all the universe was designed for us to do something with, and therefore we should be involved in all of it and use it as we wish. Okay. Top of the page, he says, already in the days of Abraham, at the dawn of Jewish history, its circumcision had this significance. It was the first command given specifically to a Jew. Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we think of, clearly we associate circumcision with Judaism, but the fact of the matter is circumcision was practiced by the Egyptians as well. But not as a command. So what he's saying is the first, if we think of Abraham as the beginning of Judaism, then this is unlike Adam, who is given a command about eating. The first command given to a Jew is about circumcision. And he says, it first appears in the great passage in Genesis 17 where God outlines the covenant. So the first thing that we find about Judaism is the symbol of the covenant relationship. That's what marks it out differently than the first 16 chapters of Genesis, which are basically about humankind in general. And then he goes, we're going to skip over to 168. He's at the bottom of the page. He says, but what about the religion of Abraham? Other than circumcision, Abraham was given no commands. Did you get that? This is amazing, because we often think of Judaism as founded in Abraham. And so Abraham must have, known the Torah, worked his way through the Torah, done Torah studies, et cetera, et cetera. But look what Sachs is pointing out. Only one command was ever given to Abraham. He says, nor do we find him challenging his contemporaries about idolatry. He does not speak as a prophet. He does not deliver a critique of polytheism. He does not call on all humankind to worship the one God. Only in Midrashic tradition is Abraham the breaker of idols and the maker of converts. These things are not explicit in the text itself. What then is distinctive about the life of Abraham? Okay, so let's stop there and recognize that the legends about Abraham destroying the idols and becoming one God worshiper, et cetera, are from the Midrash. They're explanations given to Abraham's, or not they're amplifications given to Abraham's behavior based on rabbinic thinking from millennia later, read back into the stories. Okay, so now let's see if we can answer Sack's question. What then is the distinctive about the way of life Abraham represents? The book gives us one inescapable clue. Wherever and whenever a member of the covenant family finds himself or herself entering another society or group, there is always a moment of danger. And that danger is always rooted in an absence of sexual ethics. Okay? So now think of, and then he's going to talk about the six episodes. So now think of what he's saying about the one thing that makes Abraham's life different than all the rest of the society around him. And it has to do with the mark of the covenant in circumcision. And why is that important? Because it represents a difference in sexual ethics in Abraham's tribe, ultimately, then different than any of the other societies around him. And he specifies all these. He talks about the occasions with Abraham and Sarah, et cetera, et cetera. And fourth episode, fifth episode, and then at the bottom, then halfway down page 170, he says, so we have six episodes, in five of which there is an actual or potential violence, and in the sixth, a flagrant miscarriage of justice. And all are about sexual desire. Hence, the unexpected conclusion that what makes the difference between the patriarchs and the matriarchs of Genesis and their neighbors is less religious belief than sexual ethics. Isn't that interesting? Right? You can really think about that in today's world. What makes the difference between those who are followers of the one true God and the rest of society? And if it comes down to just one thing, from Abraham's perspective, it's how we deal with sexual desire. That's basically the bottom line. Abraham had a different approach, even though he certainly messed it up along the way. His approach, instituted by God, was to be radically different in that one aspect, right? Now he says on page 171, the argument was recently restated by William Tucker in Marriage and Civilization, How Monogamy Made Us Human. I have that book. It's really good. He sums up this argument in these words. In almost all species, males spend most of their time fighting among themselves for access to females. The unique social contract of monogamy, a male for every female, female for every male, lowers the temperature of sexual competition and frees its members to work together in cooperation. It is at this juncture that human societies, even human civilizations, are born. So, what he's suggesting is, Tucker's book suggests that, the invention of monogamy was a response to the violence of acquisition, of sexual acquisition. Right? Really interesting. Because if you read the histories of the ancient worlds, you will see that the powerful acquire additional sexual partners, right? But in Judaism, monotheism removes that potential for violence by relegating how the sexual union is supposed to be handled, right? I think it's really, really important. And, of course, Sachs is pointing out that in Leviticus, where we have all of these prohibitions, what we're really doing is creating a society that's immune to violence. That's the whole idea, is to figure out how we can create a society where violence is not the answer to disagreement. Okay? So, now he's going to talk about the Genesis 6 passage. It's on page 172. Where he says, the bottom paragraph, who were the sons of God and the Titans, Nephilim? Most commentators translate the first phrase as sons of rulers or judges. They were people in positions of power. Sadi Gion and Maimonides understand the phrase daughters of man as girls or women of the lower classes, commoners, serfs, or slaves. Titans is as graphic a word as we could want for alpha males. In short, the Torah is telling us what we already know from other sources, that in the evolution of from hunter-gatherer to settled populations and the growth of civilization, there was a breakdown in sexual ethics, right? That the powerful acquired multiple sexual partners, and as a result of that created dissension and ultimately violence within the civilization. So he says on the top of 173, the central message of Genesis is that of sexual anomie, the unfettered play of Darwinian forces in alpha males, that leads to a society marked by widespread violence. I'll skip down a couple of sentences. It places power, not love, at the heart of human relationships. It treats women as objects rather than subjects with equal dignity and integrity. It divorces sex from compassion and concern. It dishonors the most intimate human bond. Then the next paragraph, above all, though, it leads to violence. And the Torah regards violence, the cause of the flood, as the single greatest threat to humanity. Did you get that? That's really important because we would expect it to say that the Torah regards idolatry as the single greatest threat to humanity, but that's not what he says. What he says is that when there is a disparity in how a civilization handles its sexual ethics, it leads to violence, and violence leads to the collapse of a civilization. You cannot have a civilization where violence becomes the modus operandi for dealing with conflict, right? And he says that this starts in the acquisition of sexual partners, and God is the one who puts a stop to that right at the beginning by instituting a prohibition by circumcision, which establishes a relationship between the sexes that is that permanently removes the idea of acquisition by power. Okay? That's really important stuff. So, he says at the bottom of 174, he's finishing this, right? This is the key to understanding Brit Milah. It is the consecration of sexual desire. Judaism takes a balanced view of the human personality. Our instincts are not evil in themselves. The religious life is not a matter of self-denial and renunciation, but neither is it hedonism, the unrestrained pursuit of pleasure. Instinct has its darker side, which culminates in violence. The good life involves education of the passions and the acquisition of habits of self-restraint. The holy life involves the sanctification of instinct. Only thus can we create a gracious society in which love, not power, rules the affairs of humankind. Okay? And on these cruises, I often lecture about the fall of the Roman Empire. And one of the things that you realize from the fall of the Roman Empire is that Rome's sexual ethics were based on power, not on gender, not even on gender. They were based on who is the most powerful. And the whole arrangement of hetero and homosexual involvement in Rome was all about power politics, right? It was a display of who was powerful. And we have the same kind of crazy stuff going on today. We're exactly at that point in where the Romans were, when gender issues were set aside, and the traditions were removed that allowed the culture to redefine its sexual ethics. And as Sachs points out, and as the biblical text reminds us, when that happens, we enter into the path of violence that ultimately will lead to the flood, right? And the destruction of human society. Okay? Comments before we get to the next little section? No? Are you still hearing me?
Yeah. Okay. Skip David. It's interesting. I don't know if any of you were following the release of the Epstein files and what has really been going on, but the latest things that are coming out are how the elite of the world are in that position of dominance and power through sex.
Yeah, they were operating just like at the end of the Roman Empire, and it's still happening today.
They were and still are.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Maddie, you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask, Skip, the lectures you were talking about, are they available to purchase on your site?
Oh, I think they're not to purchase. I think you just download it or you can watch it. One of them is on my YouTube channel.
Okay.
So if you go to YouTube and Skip Moen, you're going to see it. It's called Conflict of Civilizations or End of the Empire or something like that. It's the one about Rome.
Okay.
And it talks about what happened at the end of the Roman Empire. Yeah. It was done about a year ago, so it's probably not updated as my most recent one was, but it'll give you the general idea, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any other comments up to this section? Because otherwise we'll stop today and before we get going on the next section. No? We're good? Everybody is on board? We can hear?
We can hear you, Skip. Yes. These last few from page 150 on, really, it's hard to comment. You can pretty much comment on every line.
Yes.
They're amazing.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, I think the most fascinating thing is we're studying the book of Leviticus. I mean, this is as from the general perspective of Leviticus, we often think of Leviticus as nothing but a bunch of religious rules. And what Sachs is pointing out is that it's fundamental to the survival of society, that what we're really discovering in Leviticus is a foundation that has to do with whether or not civilization will survive. I mean, that's quite an amazing thing. Lindy, you wanted to add something?
I just wanted to add the fact that we remember that in the Orthodox community, the first book children begin learning is Leviticus.
Yes, but now we can understand why. Because, I mean, look what we've talked about. We've talked about a lot of different things, but today we talked about the reason that we have kosher requirements and the reason that we have monotheism. I mean, sorry. Monogamy. So those two fundamental ideas, one about the sustenance of the body and one about the relationship of sexual ethics to the society, are fundamental to the way human beings are interacting with each other. And here in a book about supposedly about religious rules, we find the foundation being laid for how a civilization will actually survive. And of course, that means that as we look around us, we realize we're on a path to absolute destruction. I mean, think about the rise of violence in the American political scene. How did that happen? You think just that suddenly people decided to be violent in their response to disagreements in politics? I would say no. I would say that it happened because 40 years ago, we started on the path of destroying the traditional relationships for sexual ethics, and we're now reaping the rewards of that. We don't connect the idea of gender identification with violence, but we should, because the biblical text is telling us that once you start on that path, these issues become, or these problems become inevitable, right? Isn't that interesting? Right? That we're rethinking what was happening prior to the flood in terms of our own civilization and recognizing that the same patterns are there. Maddie, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the paragraph, the second to last paragraph about Freud, placed sexuality at the heart of analysis of the human personality, and it ends with a sentence, civilization for Freud depended on the ability to defer instinctual gratification. Oh, wow. I mean, I can basically say, you know, just for me thinking back from the 60s through the 70s, through the 80s, through the 90s, through today, wow, my, what have we done?
Yeah. Yes, we you know, people today decry the all of the violence that's happening in the political world, but they don't recognize, as Sachs recognizes, that it started a long time ago, and it started with the breakdown of these traditional and critical demarcations, the boundaries that God put in place for a civilization to survive, and we've been breaking them down for 40, 50 years, and now we're going to reap it. We're going to reap the result of that. And people, and what's interesting is that people who decry the violence do not offer a solution. Their solution isn't going to help, because we've undermined the values that kept the society, moving. And now without those mooring pins, we're going to be in real trouble. I do not see an end to this. At least I don't see a happy end to it. Okay, anybody else make a comment before we quit for today? All right.
For those of you that have happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. Next time we meet, I'll be back in Parma, and we'll have a much better connection, I think. Okay. All right, so enjoy your holiday and be safe, and give some serious thought to what we've talked about, and maybe we can come up with even more insight into what's happening here. So, okay, I will see you next week. We'll start on page 176. Okay, great.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you for showing up today.